Good morning. Calling the meeting to order. This is State Government Finance for Thursday, January 27th. Appreciate everyone being here today. We're still a couple short of a quorum, so we will hold off on the minutes, but we got a lot of ground to cover here, and so we want to proceed with the overview on the Department of Administration. They cover a lot of ground, lots of different pieces to that department, and so we need to hear from them as to all of what they have to address and deal with on our behalf. So Acting Commissioner Ryan Church is going to kick it off. So Commissioner Church. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Ryan Church, and I'm the acting commissioner in the Department of Administration. I joked a little bit yesterday that I have to listen to myself on my introductions because I've had three new titles in less than 3 years. So, but, you know, that's probably a good thing, and certainly is invigorating. And I can imagine that at least those of you who are new to the Minnesota legislature also have a new hat. That can be invigorating, and I think you can relate to the idea of that it gets you up in the morning, and you certainly come to work wanting to do your very best as a public servant for this great state, and I think we share that. The other thing that I'm struck by is this ongoing conversation and this new sense of urgency to talk about state reform and what we can do to make government as efficient and as effective as possible. And that is just spot on with what our department is about, what we're going to be talking about today, and so it's good also to be sharing that interest and that focus. And maybe that can just really be a thematic focus as we talk about the many activities within the agency. I think if we do that, we're going to use your time well this morning. So again, Mr. Chair, our purpose here is pretty simple today. It's an overview. We're basically trying to help acquaint you with the kinds of things that go on within in the department, basically our function or our role within state government operations. And to approach this, I want to go at this a couple different ways. First of all, I'll provide just a very brief overview, really focusing on the mission, the goals, a snapshot of the agency budget. And then what we're going to do is, rather than, and Mr. Chair, you and I talked about this a couple of weeks ago, rather than trying to cover everything that we do, we do have a little brochure. I think most of you have seen this. That lists all of the divisions within the agency, gives a little one or two sentence introduction to that activity, and so we can talk about any of these things. But what we're going to do today is try to focus your attention on a few sample areas of business. And we really want to do this in a way that goes right at what is the basic approach that we take in those areas, what are some recent innovations that we've employed. Focus on results. We don't want to talk about reform or efficiency in a theoretical or an abstract way. We want to talk about real experience, the real results, and then also talk about, as we go forward, what are some things that we might be doing differently to get better at what we do. So that's basically the approach, and we'll have a few other people come up. We can take questions as we go, and I'm hoping that we'll be able to use this time well. So if it's okay with you, Mr. Chair, I'll just proceed on that basis.
Sounds good. Okay. Proceed.
Great, thanks. So I think you've got a set of slides, and we've got projection here, so I'm just going to go through these. This first slide talks about who we are. And, you know, I didn't know this until just a couple of weeks ago, but the Department of Administration was created in 1939 by Governor Harold Stassen as a part of a comprehensive effort to reform and professionalize state government administrative services. And if you think about the reforms of the 1930s, you can probably imagine, you know, there were some good things that happened as a result of those reforms, but there was also some things that created unintended consequences. Some of the rules and structures and processes that we live with today, and in fact are the topic of reforms today, came out of that period. So that's part of who we are. But the main thing, I think, that was important about that reform, and it's still sound today, is the idea of using economies of scale. It's using specialized expertise. to bring value to government services and make them as efficient and as effective as possible. And so when we talk about the examples, we go through some of the business areas we'll be talking about today, you'll see specific examples of how we try to use those basic strategies and the results that we're getting. The other thing that I think is just important for you to kind of get a handle on before we get too deep into this is the way the department operates. We primarily are a collection of businesses, if you will, and we collect fees to support our costs. So we're really a fee-for-service operation to a very large extent, and when I show you a snapshot of the budget, you'll see what I mean. And it looks different than many other agencies that you'll see because of our dependence on the fee-for-services for the customers, for the services that we provide our customers. The next piece here is just our mission, very simple, to help our customers succeed. Who are our customers? Primarily, they are state agencies. We certainly work outside of that boundary. We work with local governments. We work with school districts. We work with colleges and universities. But it's probably most helpful to think of us as an internal service, if you will, across state agencies. Those are primarily our customers. We have four goals, and I want to talk about these for just a minute so you understand why they're important to us and how we use them to manage performance across the variety of operations we have within the agency. First of all is to provide our customers with valuable services, products, advice, and expertise. You know, it's not hard to imagine, and you'll certainly see as people come up here and talk about their business areas, you'll see that they have specialized expertise. And it's not too hard to imagine that if you're a manager in some agency and you need to purchase a specialized piece of equipment, or maybe you have a helicopter and you need to insure it, you're a local law enforcement agency and you have forfeited or seized property that you need to convert into cash, it's really incredibly valuable to them to be able to turn to someone who has the expertise that can take that on, either satisfy the need with our internal resources or sometimes going to the marketplace to find the specialized expertise that we need to get them back to work. And that's important because then it just allows them to focus their attention and their resources back on their primary mission. The second thing is to be recognized for our innovation and efficiency. Because agencies face ongoing cost pressures, we have to be very cost competitive. We got to be the best deal in town. We got to bring value. Otherwise, we're not in business. And that's how we achieve that. And so we'll look to technology. We'll look to all kinds of different ways that we can work differently, do things differently to add value and get the best services to them for the lowest possible cost, because otherwise it's a drain on those state resources. Thirdly, we want to reduce costs by working across government. This is kind of back to that original idea of the economies of scale. How can we group up those resources? How can we focus those resources most productively? A good example, you'll hear more about others later. I'll just mention one right now, our cooperative purchasing venture. And this is basically a program that allows not only state agencies, but local governments, school districts, higher education, to purchase off of the more than 700 state contracts. So again, it's just a way to group up that spend and be more strategic, have more brokerage, leverage power within the market to get those benefits, and the local government units can buy right off of those contracts. So that's what we mean by working across government, not just state, but other jurisdictions as well. You'll hear more about that later. And then lastly, to offer a safe environment where people thrive and enjoy their work. You know, I don't think the word safe showed up anywhere in our goals or our mission or anything until about 2 years ago when the Department of Employee Relations was eliminated and the Workers' Compensation Program came from that agency into the Department of Administration. It didn't take long. You look at that program, you look at what we pay out in claims in the state, you look at the aging population, and you realize there's a lot of things that we have difficulty controlling, the cost of medicine, the complex procedures that are now being applied, those kinds of things are a challenge for all of us. But if there's anything we can do, it's to prevent those injuries in the first place. And there's never been a better time for that prevention argument when you look at that cost projection line on medical costs, hospitalizations, and the like. This is the time to get good at this. So basically, those four goals are important because they really provide a foundation for our performance management work, and I'm going to say more about that in just 1 second. The next slide gives you a quick snapshot of the agency budget. And as I mentioned, if you look at this, kind of the first impression I think you can see is that if you look at kind of the light yellow and the light blue areas, the larger portions of this pie chart, that really is the fee-for-service part of what we do. That represents the businesses that we operate and provide the services. The darker shaded areas up there in that noon to 1 o'clock area, that really is the state general fund dollars. And about half of that are really pass-through dollars. Those are funds that are appropriated by the legislature to specific grantees, such as public broadcasting. The Department of Administration takes no cut of those dollars. Those are straight pass-through dollars to those entities. The other part of the general fund dollars do support those core activities within the agency for which a fee-for-service model really is not suitable. So in the end, I guess what you see is that we 7% is kind of where we've been. We're getting closer to 6% of the total budget being general fund supported for our activities.
Commissioner, a question from Representative Gunther.
Your able staff just gave me the answer. Thank you.
Okay.
Well, we'll ask it so many. Do we buy with other states to get even better better buying power?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Gunther, yes. In fact, we're going to have a focus on purchasing in just a second, and you'll hear about at least one program. You're nodding because you probably know about this, but for example, our there are two group purchasing organizations that actually the Department of Administration administers on behalf of many other states. And that, again, is just one more extension of our ability to group that spend and leverage our brokerage power in the market. So we'll come back to that one. If that answers your question.
Thank you. You may proceed.
Okay. The next thing I want to make sure we talk about is just this managing performance. And again, I just want to talk about this so you understand why this is important to us as an organization. As I mentioned, we have the four goals, and then what we have is of all of the divisions within the agency, every one of these divisions, every business area in the agency then takes those goals, develops specific business-specific objectives, and those objectives are based on data about customer needs, cost, and results. Those basic metrics then are reviewed every quarter. So department manager, and I think we've got a sample, I hope, in your packet that you would have seen, just a little sheet here. This is one example of one division in the agency. I think this is plant management for the year 2010. And what you can see, and I don't expect you to look at all of these numbers right now, but what you can see here is that based on that one broad goal, for example, provide customers with valuable services, products, advice, and expertise, they've broken that down into specific business objectives, and they monitor those on a quarterly basis. They produce this little written report every quarter. We have a brief meeting where the manager meets with the executive leadership team of the agency, and we talk about how we're doing on each of those areas of objectives or progress. We look at the financial condition of the operation, and we also take some time to think openly and creatively about what could we be doing differently. Is there another way to skin this cat? Could we go to the market in a different way? Is there a new technology we could use? Is there another customer group or another state we could partner with? These are all things that we need to do on an ongoing basis to make sure that we're getting the best value for our money. And I think what's important about this routine and this exercise in the agency is that it forces us to think creatively. It's a way to routinize creative thinking and looking for new ways to do business. We have to break the mold of we've done it this way. We need to think differently about what we can accomplish. And you'll see some specific results of changes we've made and the benefits that we've been able to accomplish with that. It also supports, if you will, this culture. It's a mindset. It's an analytical mindset. It's a business mindset. And it's a way to think about how can we get better at what we do every day. Kind of a culture of continuous improvement. Next, I want to go into these kind of sample business areas. And again, we're not trying to cover everything. We're trying to cover some key areas that I know that there's some interest in here in the committee. We're going to talk about purchasing, talk about leasing. We've got a neat story about energy conservation within the Capitol complex. And we also know that there's some interest in what we've been doing in the Lean program. It's a partnership that we have with General Mills to make our operations more efficient and effective. So if it's all right, Mr. Chair, what I'll do is just go ahead and move right into that. I'll ask Kent Allen, who is our chief procurement officer, to join us, and we'll start in on those discussions. Unless there's any questions before we start there.
Representative Benson has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm just looking at your performance goal summary, just a clarification. In the middle of the sheet, there's an average lost time hours per employee column, or columns. There's four or five of them, actually, and it shows that year-to-date is 30. Can you explain that? That's not lost work day due to accidents. Is that sick leave, or...
I want to make sure I'm with you here. I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Benson. Can you help me find the one?
Sure. Under to be recognized for innovation and efficiency, in the middle of that, it says average lost time hours per employee. Is that lost work days to what?
That is lost time, and what I'm just trying to get clear in my own mind is we've got a couple of different measures you'll see there. One is the non-FMLA lost time.
Okay.
You want to jump in here, Dave? I think, just to get clear, there's the average lost time, it's non-FMLA time, and then there's the other one that focuses on the average time per employee.
Yes, Representative and Committee, my name is Dave Fielding. I'm the Director of Plant Management. This is my report card for last year. In this particular area, there were two metrics that we had, one of which was to measure the previous year's lost time in hours. And the goal in this particular year was to reduce, in fiscal year 10, to reduce the total hours lost relative to the 2007 base by 25%. But in addition, there's a metric across the agency which says, in addition to an absolute hour goal, we were looking to achieve an average lost hours per employee in the work unit by no more than 30 hours, or roughly a little less than 4 days a year.
A follow-up question. For my clarification, I worked in the government for many years, and most of the reports that I had to to review and be responsible for, like you are on a daily or weekly basis, were lost work days as they relate to accidents and lost work days as they relate to sick leave. So, there's a big difference in terms of the inherent costs related to those kinds of categories. So for the sake of me, at least, I'd like to know whether or not those are combination of everything. Lost work day is related to accidents, which usually means the agency gets, a bill for all the medical costs that's usually unfunded, or are they drawing from a benefit, sick leave, or what that is? There's replacement costs and overtime and...
Representative, it's not an all-inclusive number, because quite often when you have worker comp lost time, that is categorized separately, but there is some percentage of workers' comp lost time in here. What is not in this number are absences that are authorized under the federal FMLA program.
Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, do you ever look at lost time in terms of lost output, in terms of output going way down? And let me think of let me bring up a specific example that I know. I know that the last time, so many years ago, when government was shut down, and when a shutdown of government was threatened, that there was obviously a huge amount of lost time as people started recomputing their vacations and just all stressed out by it. Did anyone look at what happened to productivity in that period of time, both before the month before the shutdown and actually during the shutdown? Is there any way, instead of measuring a lost time in terms of lost outcomes, not just lost time?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, it's a great question. I don't know whether or not anything like that's been done. I would think if it had been, it would have been done either by the Department of Employee Relations at the time, if they existed. Otherwise, that would now be within the Minnesota Management and Budget. But it's a great question. This whole idea of lost time and productivity really is the question of the day, because we're seeing a massive change in our workforce. Within the Department of Administration, I hope someone's going to correct me if this is wrong, but I recently looked at our statistics in terms of the number of people leaving our agency. It's between 20 and 25% of the people within the agency are going to hit or be above the average retirement age within the next 12 months. I mean, that's a huge shift. That alone, and we couldn't fill all those positions if we, you know, had to. We're going to have to find a way to function differently and perform at a higher level. And so when you have people gone, either through a workers' comp lost day, or they're sick, or they're using sick leave excessively, or out because of a shutdown or anything else, those are huge impacts on our ability to produce the benefits we're intended to produce.
Well,
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, I know there's been a little talk about zero-based budgeting, but the most better direction to go is the direction I think that the state of Connecticut has gone in terms of outcome-based budgeting and results-based budgeting. And it seems to me that if you're doing that, one of the things that you want to look at when you're doing that kind of budgeting is employee productivity.
Yeah. Well, Mr. Chairman and Representative Kahn, you know, the part I would want to underscore there is sort of the outcome and focusing on results. And you'll see in our examples, that's really the discipline that we're trying to cultivate within the agency. Let's focus on the results. Let's focus on the business objectives. Let's focus on those as real measures of productivity and see what we can do. So if you like, we can dive right into those examples, or if there are other questions, we're happy to take those, too.
Mr. Chair, just one continuing one. Are you going to go into the Lean program, some of the things that the Lean program did a little bit, or is anyone going to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Kahn, we can't wait to get into the Lean program. So it's unfortunately fourth on the list, but we're going to keep plowing ahead because we definitely want to talk about that. Yeah. All right?
Okay. Mr. Allen.
Okay.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Kent Allen. I'm the director of the Materials Management Division within the Department of Administration. As Ryan mentioned here, he mentioned the agency mission, and as we talk about purchasing, which is a major part of our organization, obviously, there's a mission within the purchasing component as well that's spotlighted on your slide here. And it's really talking about acquiring goods and services for state government that focus on three values, and those are ensuring the best value for taxpayer dollars. One of the things we've learned is that the cheapest goods and services aren't necessarily the best deal for the state. So we try to balance the cost issue with quality and with ensuring that some of the legislative and executive branch policy objectives are built in as well. The second bullet here is especially critical, highest ethical standards. The state has over $2 billion a year in business opportunities to award to the private sector. So it's critically important that be done in a way that's fair, competitive. Thankfully, Minnesota has an excellent track record of clean government. And that actually is ensured in large part because we have some very we have some excellent procurement statutes here that assist us with that deal with issues such as conflicts of interest, organizational conflicts, whistleblower protections, and so forth. And then the last of the three elements of the mission here is really acquiring goods and services in a way that meet legislative objectives. One of the things that's sort of interesting about procurement is that it becomes a vehicle for very social and policy objectives. And so over the years, the legislature and various governors have built in a number of elements into procurement that aren't directly procurement related, but that become a part of our program. And some examples of that would include aspects of procurement that are really intended to help develop small businesses, to ensure the employment of disabled people, to deal with environmental policy issues, and so forth. The Central Procurement Office, which is within admin, oversees this state purchasing strategy. There's a slightly different responsibility as it relates to different types of purchasing. I'll mention this very briefly, but for goods and general services, our division actually is statutorily responsible for that purchasing. Although we do a lot of that through statewide contracts that are developed for the use of other agencies and local units. And we also do a lot of that by delegating the commissioner's authority to state agencies. So there are actually over 600 state employees who are trained by our division to do the lower dollar purchasing for their organizations. With respect to professional and technical contracts, the department really oversees the work of agencies in that regard. And in some cases, we developed enterprise-wide contracts for use across state agencies that involve these intellectual services. And then Ryan mentioned this cooperative purchasing element in his earlier comments. He talked about the cooperative purchasing venture, and that really is the program through which local units of government can voluntarily choose to use statewide contracts. And in fact, we have over 900 local units of government that choose to do that, at least on a case-by-case basis. Ryan also mentioned that Minnesota manages the two largest multi-state purchasing organizations within state government. We operate a pharmaceuticals program that has been joined by 46 of the 50 states, and we operate a program for the Western States Contracting Alliance, which purchases computers, and almost all states in the union participate in that program. And each of these two multi-state programs actually involves over $1 billion of sales in those commodity areas each year. But the slide talks about $2.1 billion in annual average state spend. That's looking, that's pulling out the multi-state purchases and looking at what state agencies that are under the direct purview of the Department of Administration purchase. You could probably guess the top spend categories. They happen to be healthcare and medical services as number one. Highway construction and maintenance is in close second, and everything else comes in a very distant third and fourth behind those two categories. The legislature actually did a fairly significant overhaul of the state procurement law in both 1998 and again in 2007. You can take pride in the fact that Minnesota has been cited by the Pew Center on States for having procurement laws that are viewed as a model of excellence in state procurement, in providing strong but flexible approaches to procurement. When the legislature overhauled the procurement law in 2007, the primary focus of those changes is what we'd call strategic procurement. That's really a set of tools that allow us to think of procurement less on a transactional or purchase-by-purchase basis and on more of an enterprise or a bigger picture strategic basis. And I won't mention all of these tools that are listed on your slide, but just a couple that give you some examples of the philosophical or process changes that we're seeing here. One would be in the area of product standardization. Historically, procurement organizations usually obtained for agencies exactly what those agencies thought they needed in a case-by-case situation. So, for example, with respect to computers, you might buy 10 computers of 100 different models. But what we've done is work with agencies to try to develop standards where people can agree on what they're going to buy that meet most of the needs of those agencies. So now, rather than buying 10 each of 100 different models, you might buy 1,000 of one different model. And certainly you can drive down the price by changing the formula in that way. Another area where we've been extremely successful is with negotiations. Historically, the state would award a contract to the winning responder to a solicitation process. And so the best price that you got through that process is what you paid the vendor. Through this more strategic approach, what the state really does now is consider that best price offered as the starting point for negotiations. And that's made a significant difference in what the state is able to pay for goods and services. At the bottom of the slide, you see a reference to savings and cost avoidance. It's a very fair question to ask how much we're saving the state by adopting these tools. It's a difficult question to answer with precision, and the reason for that is because there are really a considerable number of unknowns. We can't, for example, know exactly what we would have paid if we hadn't standardized on products. We can't know how much more we would have paid if we hadn't gotten these better discounts related to the higher volumes. In some cases, we can be quite precise about what we're saving, however, and one good example of that is the negotiations, because we can compare the best price that was offered through the competitive process, which is what we would have paid in the past, and compare that to the final price following our negotiations. And over the last biennium, FY 9 and 10, we actually saved over $60 million in the costs of goods and services by negotiating down those best initial prices. Another figure that involves more estimates and assumptions than that, but one that's been fairly widely used, in fact was endorsed by the Pew Center on the States when they did their analysis of Minnesota, is an estimated savings of $246 million from December of 1905 through July of 2009 using these strategic procurement processes. Minnesota has achieved what I think is fair to say is a national reputation for innovation and excellence in procurement. Certainly, I have a bias to believe that, but I have some objective third parties that would agree with me. Again, the Pew Center for the State did a case study of Minnesota and Virginia, and they issued a report that they call States Buying Smarter, Lessons Learned from Minnesota and Virginia. And in this analysis, they credit Minnesota for innovation, success in negotiations, measurement, collaboration, and persistence. And they say that the key policies through which Minnesota has achieved its success, and many of these actually relate to the statutory authorities that this body has provided us, these key policies are statutory authority for procurement reform, a statutory commitment to ethics and whistleblowers, a robust and independent central procurement agency, strong joint powers agreement authority enabling two or more public entities to collaborate. In addition to that recognition, Minnesota was recognized in the governing magazine Grading the States for strength in contracting and purchasing, and Minnesota won the Cronin Award for Procurement Excellence in two out of the last 4 years. That's an award issued by the National Association for State Purchasing Officials. Well, what kinds of things are we working on now that would be viewed as innovative or deserving of recognition? One is the SWIFT system. I know you've heard some reports from MMB about the work progressing there, and it has been, as I think they've told you, a bit of a struggle. Things are not fully on schedule. But I think it's fair to say that when the SWIFT project is completed successfully, that on the procurement side, we will have what I think will be the most paperless procurement system of any state in the country. Another area where we're doing some interesting work is in enterprise contracts. We've particularly moved into creating statewide contracts in the professional technical area, which hadn't been done until a few years ago. Perhaps our most successful one involves IT consultants. We have a program through which IT consultants can now be placed in agencies within 48 hours if needed, and at rates that are 25% below what the state had been paying previously for these sorts of services. We're also developing enterprise contracts as it relates to occupational health, and consultants to work on accessibility issues for the disabled. On the commodities side, we have a new enterprise contract that's, I think, of more than casual interest in that it involves travel, airline fares, booking hotels, and so forth. As you probably know, state employees are not statutorily eligible to use frequent flyer miles. So the state has been paying for airline tickets and not really getting one of the benefits that's usually associated with those tickets. Through this new contract, we have a consolidator that actually will be providing the equivalent of frequent flyer mile benefits to the agencies based on their volume of travel bookings. So no longer is the state, you know, losing a benefit associated with the cost of air travel. One last example of current innovations is the accessibility implementation of the statutory directive we got from this body 2 years ago to ensure that the IT technology that the state buys is accessible to individuals with disabilities. This is an example of where we had a truly outstanding partnership with OET and with the disability community and tackled a problem that I don't think either the federal government or any other state had really resolved yet, and that's how to buy accessible hardware and software that meets the needs of the disability community but also recognizes the level of market maturity with respect to these products and recognizes the need to ensure that the costs that we're paying for these are affordable to state government. And balancing those interests, this coalition of stakeholders developed what we're calling a procurement matrix for accessibility that we really think has found a way to ensure that all of those objectives are responsibly met. If you're looking at the slides, you now are seeing that we have future opportunities listed there, and it's kind of a blank slate under that. That's not because we don't think there are any. It's mostly because we want to ensure that the executive and legislative branches sort of take a lead with us on deciding the direction they would like to see some of these programs going. But to give you examples of a few things that you could be thinking about and that we'd be happy to work with you on, one would be a reduction in the use of professional technical contracts in the state. We've seen some estimates of savings that are possible there that we think are probably overly optimistic, but we do think there is some opportunity there for savings and reductions. Another area would be the possibility of reconsidering or evaluating the pros and cons of the various statutory requirements that don't really relate to procurement directly. And I mentioned some of those earlier. I want to be clear that we're not advocating for any particular social or policy requirements to be eliminated. They all have important public policy implications, and they all have stakeholder groups who are interested in them. But they do add cost and complexity to the procurement process. So if this body or the new governor decided that there were areas there that are worthy of reconsideration, we certainly think that's a possibility. Just to give you some ideas of the types of non-procurement policy objectives that are built into procurement laws, we have a number of preferences for particular types of businesses, their requirements as to where products are made, requirements regarding immigration status of the workers working on state contracts, wage levels paid to workers, numerous environmental considerations, affirmative action requirements, prevailing wage requirements, and others. So another area of opportunity, I think, would be renegotiation with respect to some of the professional technical or other contracts that are in place. And we're very happy to work with you as we move forward on any or all of these issues. That's it for me, unless you have questions.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. Under the category of potential future opportunities, a question that I have is, do we have a handle on all of what the state rents rather than purchases? Obviously, I'm not talking just about space here. We need to talk about that, leasing of space. But is somebody tracking what we're renting as a state and whether or not it would make more sense for us to purchase some things rather than rent?
Mr. Chair, do you have examples of the types of things where you think rent versus purchase would be an option? I mean, I'm sure we have data like that with respect to things like copy machines and so forth, where agencies make business judgments as to the more desirable approach. Are there other commodity or service or commodity areas that you're thinking of specifically where you'd like us to dig some of that out for you?
Well, obviously, one thing that we as legislators are aware of is the fact that the state is paying to rent furnishings for apartments, and over a period of time, we're ending up paying a whole lot more to rent than it would be if we had a supply of furnishings that legislators could use. But I don't know to what extent we're renting. That's my question. Are we doing much renting of equipment or furnishings or whatever? If nobody's tracking that, it seems to me we ought to be, and evaluating whether or not there is some opportunity there for savings. That's my question. Commissioner, do you have...
Mr. Chair, I think it's a great question. I don't know the answer to that. What data we have about the amount of rental equipment we maintain in the state. I just don't have a good sense of that, but I think it's a great question. We could try to find more information on it.
We can try to dig into that. I'm not sure what we'll have available, but let's make our best effort to see what we can tell you.
Well, it would seem to me that we ought to know, have some sense as to what extent that's going on. Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, a couple questions. You mentioned under future opportunities at the end here that one possibility would be to decrease the number of technical contracts?
Professional technical contracts, intellectual service contracts, yes, sir.
So, for example, a computer person who comes in and advises us to technical matters. Well, Mr. Chair, then, Mr. Allen, my question is one way to resolve that you're suggesting that instead of farming that out, that would be done in-house?
Mr. Chair, Allen? Representative, it could potentially be done in-house. In some cases, there may be certain contracts where the legitimate question might be whether it was needed in the first place. Is it really an essential service to be provided to the state? So the options would be to cancel the contract entirely or to use a different source, and that in some cases might be state employees. There shouldn't be too many instances where professional technical contracts are going to consultants if there are state employees able and available to do them, because by statute that's not allowed. So there is an attempt before a contract is awarded. An agency needs to certify that there aren't state employees able and available, so it should be the rare exception if something has fallen through the cracks that way.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Allen, so are you... I just want to make sure I understand what the... And forgive me, this is not my area of expertise, all the computer stuff, but are you suggesting that maybe there are places where instead of using technical contracts with consultants that state employees, if not current state employees, could do it, then hiring someone in-house to do it would be the better option?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, there certainly could be instances where an analysis of the costs of those two options might suggest that use of state employees would be more cost-effective.
Representative Simon.
Thank you. Mr. Allen, one area that I don't think you touched on, and maybe this isn't your area and maybe it's someone else's, motor vehicle purchases or leases. I was recently contacted by a constituent who had an idea about that, and I mean, this is just all anecdotal, and maybe we can discuss it offline. And as is often the case, at least in my opinion, sometimes it's state workers who have the best ideas about efficiencies, and that rather than, you know, larding up the system, they actually have the ideas about how things can work more efficiently. And this was one such example. Maybe we can talk offline, but the general principle that she said is, you know, she encountered a situation where her work group had a car assigned to it because they often have to travel on short notice to far-flung parts of the state. And her observation was that at one point they just got a new car. And her point was that, well, they didn't necessarily need one. This one could have lasted another couple years or 2-3 years. It wasn't in the best shape, but they didn't necessarily need a new one right there. Again, not an area that I've looked into, but it was intriguing, and it was just this last weekend at a meeting in my district. So could you touch just briefly, if I know we're limited for time, Mr. Chair, and maybe we can talk offline, I want to take up the committee's time, but in terms of motor pool, how many cars do we own or lease in the state, And what are the criteria for determining when you need a new one? Because this constituent thought that maybe they didn't. They could have used it for another 2 or 3 years.
Commissioner?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yeah, we could probably spend a good chunk of time talking about fleet. It's a good question. We can talk offline or come back to the committee. But the Central Motor Pool has about 1,700 vehicles. And your question about sort of the criteria you use to decide when to buy a new one, basically what happens is when a vehicle is purchased, a life cycle for that vehicle is estimated based on a cost per mile. And on average in the state, we try to run that about 40 cents per mile over the lifetime of that vehicle. And then what we'll do is we'll monitor the utilization of that vehicle, and we try to always keep that within a 10% band. It's one of those other performance metrics you would see if you looked at that business unit's metrics. If we find that a vehicle is underutilized, of course what happens is the cost of that vehicle goes up. The per unit or per mile cost goes up. So we would either try to reassign that vehicle or find another way to share it. Or if we use vehicles that go way beyond that utilization, of course then you run the extra risk of downtime in that vehicle, which creates problems, and you got repairs and other costs that begin to escalate and make that an uneconomical use of the vehicle. So we could certainly come back and talk about that. And that example, that point may well have happened. I don't know. But what we'll try to do is always keep that within that average of about 10%. And I think from the latest metrics I saw, we're just right around 10% or a little bit over. We've got room to improve in that area for sure.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last point, and we can talk separately and offline
sure.
about motor vehicles, because I was intrigued by her observation. But you mentioned, Mr. Allen, you mentioned some of the sort of what I'll call the social or policy mandates. Let me just hone in on one category that we've seen a lot around here, and I voted for some of them, the sort of Made in America or Made in Minnesota mandates. Representative Rukavina is famous for his Made in America amendments. How much, if at all, does that interfere with, and maybe that's a loaded word, but does that impact your work? I mean, those of us who have voted for that stuff probably make a rough calculation that, well, it's worth it, it's probably going to cost a little bit more, but there's certain other values that we want out of that. What's your observation on that? Can you quantify that? When we do vote for that stuff, as I have sometimes, what, if anything, is the added cost?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Simon, I'd actually like to send you some data on that, because we do have some. We have done some solicitations where we have asked the cost of the compliant Made in America product versus alternative products made elsewhere, and sometimes the cost differential has been quite significant. And I don't have that information at my fingertips, but would be happy to send you some of that, because it is interesting.
Thanks.
Was it to that point?
No, I just wanted to ask Des to get a copy of that information.
So I do that.
Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Let me start with a follow-up to that point. Do we have a buy in Minnesota initiative at all?
Mr. Chair, Representative, we don't accept as it relates to ATVs. And it's actually important that you understand the ramifications of a buy-in Minnesota law. Most states, including Minnesota, have what's called a reciprocal preference law. And that means that we don't treat that we will discriminate against other states if they have a bill that gives a preference, if they have laws that give preference to their state with respect to their state purchasing. So if we have a preference in Minnesota for what we buy here from Minnesota businesses, other states will actively impose a penalty against Minnesota businesses. And even without a Buy Minnesota preference in our law, we've done some analysis that shows that over 70% of what we spend through the state procurement system is going to businesses with addresses in Minnesota.
I'm not an advocate of it, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
I'm not an advocate. I just wanted to know if we had that. Mm-hmm. I have just a couple of questions on really its process and the scope, if I can ask those.
Sure, go ahead.
Are there any agencies, government agencies, that procure outside the system run by the administration department?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, the only entity that's normally defined as a state agency that is not part of the admin system is MNSCU. They were pulled out about 15 years ago.
Representative Leidiger?
Can you provide some rationale on that, please?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I assume MNSCU could provide better rationale than I could, but at the time they articulated the desire to have autonomy that would make them more like the University of Minnesota, I believe. And the university isn't part of our system either, but as you know, they have a separate constitutional status that is unique to the university.
Representative Leidy.
A couple more, and I'll go quick. Do most of the agencies find their own vendors and then bring them to you?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative, most agencies use statewide contracts whenever possible. There are 1,500 of those, so the things that people routinely buy can most frequently be purchased from state contracts. When they need to buy something that's not on state contract, they wouldn't routinely bring us a vendor. They would bring us their explanation of what they need or specifications for what they need, and hopefully done in such a way, and we would try to review that to ensure it's done in such a way that there's not just one vendor who would be capable of responding to that. There's some instances where an agency will articulate a need to hire a particular vendor or buy from a particular vendor, but there's a fairly stringent process they have to go through to justify a non-competitive purchase like that.
Representative Leidiger.
And just approximately, I'm trying to get an idea of the scope here and the processes. Approximately what percentage of the procurement is pretty much on contract?
Mr. Chair, Representative Leidiger, I would want to check real data before I gave you a definitive answer. It's certainly the majority, but I'll try to get you a number that is more precise. My guess would be 70 to 80%, but that is a guess.
And 20% then are usually specialty purchases, approximately.
Or, yes.
It's just that you don't need to get any other numbers. I was just trying to get an idea. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. We have several more that have questions, and I'd like to remind members that we still have three more presenters to come before us. So, Representative Stensrud.
Chair, Mr. Church can answer. Of the 1,700 vehicles, it's my impression we own and operate a garbage truck in our state, kind of on our complex. Can you confirm that information?
Commissioner?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I recently learned that we do have a garbage truck, but I'm not sure if it's on this. Are you talking about in the Capitol complex area?
Yeah, or wherever.
Yeah. I've been rescued.
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Fielding?
In the plant management division, we have a materials transfer unit, and part of their responsibility is the collection of general trash, and we do have one vehicle that's getting old and close to the need for replacement. We do have one vehicle which collects from around the campus and then delivers down to the waste facility.
Representative Stensrud?
Hey, Mr. Chair, thank you. And just a follow-up, would we consider outsourcing those services versus buying a brand new garbage truck and being our own self-sustaining garbage company?
Mr. Field? Chair, Representative, we would certainly consider it, but I think it's been pointed out in previous testimony, there are statutes which currently at least provide certain hurdles that have to be crossed. This is a service that's being provided currently by the state with state employees, and we are under statute precluded from contracting for services when we have state employees able and available to do the work unless there are other circumstances, and those are quite unique. We had one example of that last year, but it's generally the principle that services that are currently in place would be continued as long as there are employees able and available to do the work.
Thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Church, or whoever. Do we buy foreign cars?
Mr. Chairman, Commissioner? I'm going to have Kent Allen address that question.
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, we generally do not buy foreign-made cars. I think there have been a handful of exceptions on a specific request basis and tied to environmental pilots of some sort. But as a rule, we do not.
Representative Rudolph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick follow-up. What percent hybrid cars do we have?
Mr.
Chair, Representative, we have a goodly number of flex fuel cars that operate on E85. We don't have too many hybrid cars. To get you a real number, I'd need to check with my colleagues and get back to you.
Representative Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just very quickly, a couple things. You know, one thing about facing the budget challenges we do, that it just does provide opportunities to make some real and meaningful change. I would be very interested in receiving any of the things that you feel are impediments to being as efficient as we can be, including our own garbage truck and looking towards possibility of repealing those things out of bill. So I work on a group that's looking at mandate relief, and what I've heard today, of course, is that we have a state agency that labors under the same problems as many of our local governments do. So I'd be very interested in getting a list of those things and sitting down and talking with you folks about any changes that we can make. I also sit on the higher ed committee, and just cause and me too doesn't help the taxpayer when it comes to, but we want our toy. So if Minsky can, if some real efficiencies can be gained on the administrative side of any entity, I think the public needs to know that. So whether they're constitutionally enabled to do that because they're the University of Minnesota or Minsky, where we can change it, I would like to see information relative to how we can bring some efficiencies to all of the entities that are paid by taxpayers in the state. So if you've got data that would show the number of work hours saved on combining your services, you should be doing them. I'd be interested in getting that report.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as a general comment, that wouldn't be picking on Minsky or anybody, but one of the tensions that we manage within the Department of Administration is that these other agencies do have their own constituencies. They report to their own committees. They have their own appropriations. They have their own drivers. And they often voluntarily work with us to achieve these efficiencies. So anything that we can do to make that the best deal in town or otherwise incent them to work in a central way so we can capture those economies of scale help. So I appreciate your request. And we do think that our role is to be as analytically minded and as business minded about those choices and let you make the call.
Very good. Thank you.
Representative Gauthier, and then we're going to move on.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Allen, it's probably more of a comment than a question. When you collect data between Buy American and Non-American, is there any analysis about jobs saved in that data?
Mr. Allen?
Mr. Chair, Representative Gauthier, no. What we've looked at is the cost for one versus the other. And certainly there are other impacts, and it's those other impacts that undoubtedly drove the legislation in the first place.
Well, I'm pretty confident that's why Representative Rukavina did that. And as we're quick to slice and dice state government here, I think we need to start thinking about the human casualties that we might endure because of that.
Thank you, Mr. Allen. And we'll proceed now to Mr. Fielding, is that correct?
That's correct, Mr. Chair. Dave Fielding is our Director of the Plant Management Division.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Dave Fielding, Director of Plant Management. Plant management is sort of a legacy term around here. When I came to state government about 4 years ago, one of my first thoughts was to try to change the name to more accurately reflect what we do. But what I learned is that it is so well institutionalized within state government that if I changed the name, I'd probably be spending more time than it was worth trying to explain to people that it really is plant management. But what we do is facilities maintenance and management of operations and provision of services, in addition, obviously, to the buildings, the cleaning of the buildings, the operation and repair of buildings. We also are responsible for maintaining cafeteria services. We maintain the parking services for our ramps and surface parking lots. We have responsibility for the Minnesota bookstore, for grounds maintenance, and several other miscellaneous areas. So we really cover the full range of facilities services here at the state capitol. We're responsible for 22 buildings, most of which are directly on this campus, but there are some that are in the metro area but slightly off campus, including things like the BCA building and Retirement Services building. We do have one of those buildings, which is the Department of Revenue building up in Ely, which is a bit of a trek when we have to make it, but virtually everything is here. Across those 22 buildings, we have about 4.5 million square feet of responsibility. Mr. Church, in his opening remarks, showed you the Department of Administration goals. My background in bringing the government into this position is taking goals and translating those into performance management systems, and that's what we've done in plant management. The report card, as I've referred to it, which is in your package, represents how we take those goals, turn them into specific action plans in each of these areas, and each of the individuals that reports to me is directly, their performance management system is based upon the outcomes in each of these goals. And so when you begin to take things and put them in those contexts, it's a lot easier to get people to sit up, pay attention, and progress flows from that. One of the most important things that we have on our plate of responsibilities, and it has the highest weighting for our managers, is the area of energy conservation. And so what I want to take you through quickly here is to show you the path that we have followed to improve energy consumption here on the campus.
Excuse me, Mr. Fielding. Representative Lilly, did your question?
Mr. Chair, I can wait till the appropriate.
Okay, proceed.
Sure. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. In the fall of 2005, the state brought three new buildings onto the Capitol complex, and in so doing added almost 1 million square feet. There were growing trends in energy consumption before those three buildings came. When they came, that rate of increase grew as further. And as this first chart shows you, in a 12-month moving average, the trends were not good at all. And so we set about, starting with the fiscal year 9 goals, we set about the task of reducing energy consumption by 10%. This was also in one of Governor Pawlenty's executive orders, 05-16, which was issued in the fall of 2005. As is usually the case when you move into an area like this for the first time, you don't have a lot of data, and most of what you do is trying to put the processes in place that gathers the data. But when we finally realized the challenge that we had, we understood that we needed to do more than just capture data. We had to take action. So we started by trying to understand how the energy was distributed across the buildings. This pie chart shows you that over 50% of our consumption is electrical, 24% in the area of natural gas, which is essentially in the two buildings which are not on the district energy hot water system, which is the Minnesota History Center and the BCA building. Then it flows down from that hot water at almost 20%. That is district energy, and finally 3% in chilled water, which comes from district energy. Then we took a look at the buildings themselves and the type of energy that they consume, and you can see there on the far left that the two labs and the Minnesota History Center account for almost 45% of the total energy consumption across all of our buildings. So if we were going to make a dent in reducing energy, we had to focus on those three buildings particularly. What we also recognized as we began to study the data is that the majority, 55% of the total energy that's consumed here is consumed when we're not here. It's in the evenings after we've gone home and the cleaners have finished and buttoned up for the night, and it's across the weekends. That's all that blue area that you see there. The red areas represent energy consumed during the normal operating days of the week. So the strategy was to try to find a way to control energy in the blue areas to a greater degree, to the extent that we could reduce the peaks in the red, but more importantly, shorten or narrow the operating day, bring HVAC fans on later, shut them off sooner, and to make sure that after hours, lights were being shut off and fans were being shut down. I should point out to you that we are really blessed here at the state with a software system that was put in the year 2000. It's a Honeywell EBI system. We probably have about the third largest system of this kind here in the country. We monitor over 60,000 points of HVAC controls, security, and fire life safety. And because of that system, we can truly manage each of the systems in each of these buildings on a 24/7 basis. So we know how things are supposed to run, and when they don't run according to that, if a fan stays on when it should be shut down, if it doesn't come on when it should, particularly during cold winter months like this, we know it and we can take action. This shows the response, if you will, from the plant management team to energy consumption once we set the goal, once we understood the data, and began to take steps to control operations. These improvements came not because we went out and made large investments in changes in building systems. This level of change has come about because we understand our business and we're managing the operation to a much greater degree than we ever have before. That reduction that you see there over the two-year period represents a total energy savings of over 14%, and in actual net utility cost savings, even taking into account the fact that rates went up over that two-year period of time, we saved over $1 million. Now, that money has been planned back into and will be part of the rate setting for leases in the coming years.
Representative Anderson, do you have a question to that point?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Regarding that, where you said all buildings under for your energy consumption, is that all state-owned buildings, or is that all buildings, including buildings that you lease?
Mr. Chair, Representative, what I'm showing you here and what I have responsibility and control of is strictly those 22 buildings here on the state capitol complex. What I can say is, and I think we are working to try to be sure, is that we share these learnings and best practices through our real property system, which is composed of representatives from all of the agencies, so that they can take those improvements back out into their buildings as well.
Thank you.
Proceed.
Now, as you can see, what I showed you in the previous chart was just through the end of the fiscal year, June of 2010. You'll see now that I've added in the six months of fiscal year 2011, and you'll see that we've pretty well plateaued. So what that's telling us is that we've probably extracted most of the savings that we're going to be able to extract just from pure operational changes, and so now it gets into systems improvements, and I want to share with you some of those that will be coming. We did a study within the last year of lighting, and we understand that in the electrical category that over 25% of our electrical consumption is in lighting, and that study, which comprised all of the Capitol Complex building, came up with a series of recommendations. One of the largest savings opportunities is in our parking ramps. As you know, when you drive by, you see the yellow lights, the high pressure sodium lights in parking ramps. Those lights are on 24/7. And yet, obviously, as you remember from that blue and red chart, folks are only here roughly 45% of the time. So the question is, how do you control lighting in ramps to ensure safe operations when people are here, but be able to control the use of electricity when they're not? And technology has come up with a solution for us, and it's in the form of this particular light, which has now been beta tested in the 14th Street parking ramp for about a year. We had to do some modifications with the manufacturer, so it was an iterative process. But this is an LED fixture, and in addition to using LED technology, it also, each of these fixtures has control capability in it that senses motion, and also has a photoelectric cell on it. So consequently, the way this works is that when there is motion, either from a vehicle or a pedestrian, these lights will come on and they will stay on for a predetermined point of time that's adjustable time. When that motion has not been sensed, these lights will scale down to about 10% of their total illumination. The resulting lighting is sufficient for life safety for emergency exit. The combination of savings from LED versus traditional technology lighting and the ability to control that lighting has proven, and we measured it to ensure that the savings were there, will reduce energy consumption in these parking ramps by 90%. So we now have, and that's been verified now for us by institution PB, which is a source of funding for us. And we are, through a combination of stimulus dollars and PB funding, we will be moving forward now to implement this technology in all of our Capitol campus ramps. In addition, I mentioned to you about the Honeywell control system. We control building operations, life safety, security. What we do not have centrally on control yet is the lighting in the buildings. And we have not been able to do that because the network, the fiber optic network, was not large enough to handle that additional traffic. We have just now completed updating that network, and we'll be moving forward now to bring building lighting onto that centralized control as well. Group relamping of fluorescent fixtures is an ability to go into space and take immediate efficiencies from newer technology fluorescent lamps, which have much lower mercury levels and also lower energy consumption with the same lumen output. And finally, as I mentioned PB before, this organization is planned to come into all of our state buildings. Several have been completed already, and they now take a look at the totality of the mechanical systems, electrical systems, and make recommendations for upgrades, cost-effective upgrades, wherever additional efficiencies can be found. So we've made tremendous progress in this area. We have, I think, on tap additional changes which will further reduce consumption, but it is a process, and it will take us another couple of years to get to where I want to be. So that's it.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Field, for what it's worth. It strikes me that we still have a ways to go in terms of cutting down the amount of electrical consumption here in our buildings after hours, especially. When I come back here later at night, I see routinely many more lights on than need to be, and we still have a ways to go. And I think it's good to be reminding all of us who work here and frequent this building about our own responsibility for helping to cut our consumption. The main question I wanted to ask you has to do with planning for facility improvements, expansion, and the like. Could you talk about briefly about the role and responsibility of your division in helping us address the need for facility improvements here on the campus, planning for expansion of the campus, and all of the rest?
Mr. Chair, it's a topic that I certainly play a role in, and you will hear when Mr. Waslowski comes up. This is a shared responsibility the plant management assumes along with real estate and construction services. Our primary responsibility is in forecasting the repair needs, maintenance needs on the buildings. The planning side of the development of the campus, as an example, we certainly participate in and have participated heavily in. And for example, in terms of light rail, we've been working now for 3 years in trying to anticipate the impact and implications of light rail on campus facilities, campus access. So our responsibility, I have, and we just went through it yesterday, putting in a recent update, we have a five-year projected plan across all of our buildings for all of the maintenance and asset preservation related needs for these buildings. We also last year, in concert with Real Estate and Construction Services, completed a capital complex utilization plan, which shows all of the developable sites. It shows the occupancy in buildings, the opportunities for improvements. It went through an analysis of parking needs, even in the context of light rail coming through the campus. So there's a I think this is a conversation we'd love to have with you. It probably would be one that would best be served in a sidebar meeting, but we are a principal player in that action.
Well, thank you. I guess the point I wanted to illustrate to members of the committee, having served on the CAP board, having served on the capital restoration project and capital facilities planning on the capital investment committee, we have some work to do, folks, in developing a campus master plan here. With we've got lots of players, and we have some things, frankly, that fall between the cracks. And this is something that needs a whole lot more attention than we're able to give to it here this morning. But I wanted to make everyone aware of that, and I've discussed this with Commissioner Church as well. So thank you. Representative Kahn.
Yes, Mr. Chairman and sir, a couple of questions about the energy cut. First of all, from the lights, I can't quite tell from the pictures of them. Are those downward-directed lights so that we're not getting outdoor light pollution, particularly in the parking lot?
Well, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn, the lights that you see here for the parking ramps,
yes.
Those lights are all internal to the ramp. There's no external light.
We're also talking about lots too.
We have, and thank you for reminding me. We have done some installations of LED lights in parking ramps. The most recent one is Lot W down by the Revenue Building, and we will be expanding that to do Lot Q up here by the Administration Building. Those are all downward projecting lights.
Also, I wonder if you're looking at what's going on in other states. For example, the state of Utah has just gone to a four-day work week, keeping state government open for 4 days. What effect has that had on energy? Have you looked at, do they have data on energy conservation from that and what they think that is doing?
Chairman Lanning, Representative Kahn, you know, it's interesting. When we were very much aware of that when they first started. I believe it will be 2 years in July. And shortly, I think within 6 months of the time that they implemented that, we were fortunate to participate on a conference call involving representatives from the state of Utah. And we were most interested in that particular point, energy conservation, because when we had run our own numbers, it suggested that the energy savings were simply not going to be realized. And the reason is that you're expanding your operating day. If you remember that graph I put up there, that red area will expand, even though there will be only four of them rather than five. And so when you total it all up, we couldn't get there. And when we questioned them on that, there was, I will say, there was silence on the other end of the phone. I understand that the articles have continued to suggest that they use that as a justification for the change, but I don't think the numbers are there.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a clarification. Are all LED lights CFL?
Mr. Fielding?
Mr. Chair, Representative, CFL as in compact fluorescent. Yeah, LED, there is no gas in an LED. It's a diode. It's a completely different technology. Okay. So I think the answer would be no, they're not, because they're not.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. I just wanted the clarification so I understood.
Representative Lilly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Fielding, I appreciate the efforts and the value, the improvements that you're doing. My question backs up a couple of years since I've never had a chance to meet you, or just kind of curious how you're doing with your staff. There was a situation where I think your staff wanted to get off like an hour early or something for Christmas. How are we doing?
Mr. Chair, Fielding. Representative, we're doing just fine. I should point out that I think the reason that we had that situation was that we needed to be sure that there was value received for the state for the benefit that the employees were seeking, and with the union we worked out an agreement that I think has benefited us directly, whereby on those occasions where they do start earlier so that they can leave earlier on Christmas Eve, which was the example in that case, in order to be able to participate in early starts, they have to maintain perfect attendance in the prior week. That was the quid pro quo, and once we had that agreement with the union, everything has worked out famously since.
Okay, we need to move on.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Wayne Wislowski. I'm the Director of Real Estate and Construction Services. Just real quickly, our division has four primary areas of responsibility. One is construction services. We oversee construction projects for state agencies, for a number of the state agencies. We also have the enterprise real property system, where we manage and administer that enterprise real property system. And when we have a chance, we'd love to talk to you more about the status of that project and some exciting things that are happening there. We also have an energy. Dave mentioned the PB program. That was a program that the legislature authorized a couple of years ago, and that program is administered and managed through real estate and construction services. And related to energy, we also have a B3 benchmarking and sustainability program. The fourth area, and that's the area that we're here to talk about today, is our leasing services that we provide to state agencies. That is a centralized function performed by real estate and construction services on behalf of state agencies. Under statute, all leasing activities, whether we're leasing within state-owned facilities here on the campus, the tenants and buildings have leases, as well as when we're leasing from the private market in commercial facilities. All those transactions and that management happens through our office. The benefits of the centralized structure, Ryan has talked about that, Ken talked about that in procurement. It also applies to our leasing program. We have professional staff that are trained in the industry, experienced in the industry, that are handling, negotiating the lease transactions and doing lease management. We also have adherence to states' space standards and guidelines. They're applied consistently across all state agencies. And again, as I mentioned, the leasing services that we provide are both for commercial leases in state-owned facilities. I'll first talk about our state-owned facilities. This is just a snapshot for you to touch on all the state agencies that have responsibility for management of state-owned facilities. In total, there's 5,426 buildings That consists of 30,500,000 square feet of space. And again, that there's over 20 agencies that are involved in the management of those buildings. This does not include MNSCU, and it does not include the U of M. So this is just state agencies and not higher education. Within that segment, you said, Dave had mentioned the buildings that plant management is responsible for. There is 4.5 million square feet, primarily here on the Capitol campus, consisting of 22 buildings. One of the primary metrics for our leasing group is the vacancy rate. If we have vacant space in our state-owned buildings, that means the costs related to that building get allocated to the remaining tenants. So if you have a building that's fully leased up, that drives down the costs for state agencies. If you have a higher vacancy rate in a building, you still have heating costs, you still have lighting costs, you still have your cleaning costs. Obviously, you're allocating that over less tenants. So one of our key metrics is the vacancy rate. And in the Capitol complex, we're proud that we're currently at 0.17% vacancy for office space in the Capitol complex. So that essentially means, for the most part, that we have full occupancy in our office space here on the Capitol complex. In storage, we do have some vacancy in one building in particular with our under the storage category, and we're currently working on an initiative and working with several agencies to fill that space up. Switching over to the commercial leases, I'll just give you a quick snapshot again of the portfolio. In the seven county metro area, there's 196 leases. 111 of those leases are primarily office space. In the non-metro, we have 590 leases, 238 leases are primarily office space. The total leased property is 3.6 million square feet. That's statewide. There's 786 commercial leases, and the annual rent on that is $62 million. Back to our metric and the results applicable to our leasing section. Our key metric is how are we doing compared to the market, and on average, the data that we have shows that we're performing better than the market in our rental rates. And that key word there is on average. First of all, a couple things to point out. The market is constantly changing. So a lease that you negotiated 3 years ago, 5 years ago, that may not be in today's market. You may be able to do better. So one of our large focuses is reviewing those leases on a continuous basis and renegotiating leases where possible. Some examples of savings that we've achieved through renegotiations over the past year. For the health boards, we renegotiated a 10-year lease, and over that 10-year period, we're going to save $2.6 million just simply by reducing the rental rate. Corrections and VinCor, we again renegotiated a new 10-year term. The savings over that term is $1.3 million due to reduced rates. Higher education, it was $381,000 over a 7-year term. And we currently have, we're involved in renegotiations on three larger facilities, the Attorney General's Office, Minnesota Lottery, and Deed. And so we're expecting to again realize savings through renegotiating rents. Again, the market's constantly changing, so that's one of our key metrics, is to constantly review our leases and renegotiate where possible. And just a quick point on how that happens. Well, why would a landlord be willing to renegotiate their lease? Most often that happens by extending the term. If we're getting closer to, most of our leases are 3 to 5 year terms, but we have statutory authority to go up to 10 years. And so we typically do that for our larger leases. The longer term we commit to, the lower rent we get. As we get closer to the end of the term, obviously the landlord wants to keep us in the space, so that's our best opportunity to get a good competitive rate for the space. I'm just going to The last question is, you know, what can we do differently? What can we do to achieve savings? We think there's a significant opportunity around space utilization. About a year ago, probably a year and a half ago, we've been in a more comprehensive partnership with General Mills. You've heard a little bit about that. We took a tour of their space. They have a program that took them 4 to 5 years to put in place, but it's around flexible work environments. And essentially what that is hoteling and shared space versus having an assigned workstation. And at their headquarters facility, they had a pilot project. It was a significant square footage in their pilot, where they essentially, where they have resident workers, people that show up every day. I'll use accounting staff as an example. They don't have a reason to be mobile. They do their work primarily at their workstation. They're considered resident staff, so they have an assigned workstation. But there's a large section of their group that doesn't show up every day. That they're either out in meetings or they're traveling, or even, you know, vacation time. So those are considered non-resident folks, and they don't have an assigned workstation. So if they come into work and they need just a computer and a phone, they're in a 6x6, much more open work environment than you've typically seen. If they need a conference room to hold a meeting, they have to schedule a conference room. If they need a private office for a meeting, there's private offices available. The key thing is those aren't assigned. Right now, when they did the pilot, they're using a one-to-one ratio, but they fully expect that they're going to be able to drive that down. So essentially, they'd be overselling their space. So that if everybody showed up in the same day, they'd have a problem, but that never happens. The whole workforce doesn't always show up on the same day. Industry studies suggest if we just walked around and did a survey, we would find that the traditional assigned workstations are only utilized 40% of the time. In other words, you walk around and 4 out of 10 workstations would be occupied. The other 6 would be unoccupied. We think there's a significant opportunity for the state around that. Telecommuting is having an impact on that. If people are working more from home, that has a significant impact. But you can think of the other agencies, I'll cite DNR, for example, where they do a lot of their work is out in the field and in the community. So there's many examples like that. But right now, we're currently going through a process to update our space standards, and we're going to incorporate flexible work environments so that we can have a tool to promote to state agencies. Essentially, the question is, how can we help them do the work they need to do, but with less space? And that's really, we think, a significant savings opportunity for state government as a whole.
Representative Leidinger.
Mr. Over Senate, I want to move on to lean. There's not a lot of time.
Okay.
That was it for me, Mr. Chair, if you want to.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On the page called Custodial Agencies, it says under transportation that you have 369.16 miles of rail that you lease. Is that correct? And if so, who do we lease from?
Mr. Chair, Wozniacki. Representative, that is actually represents our owned portfolio. So that would be where the state, if I'm understanding that right, this is what Department of Transportation reported to us as for their owned property. So they also have apparently some rail lines, 360, so a small mileage that is owned by the state. And presumably, I'd have to confirm this with DOT, but I would guess then that's leased to a railroad company, or there's some other entity that's actually operating the rail.
Thank you.
Mr. Bauman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and my name is Tom Bauman. I'm the program leader for the Lean program in the state of Minnesota, and I know our time is short this morning, so I will be extremely lean in my comments, but I would certainly welcome any invitation to come back and talk in more detail. Let me give you just a brief history. The program has been around since the beginning of, or since the end of 2007. It really took off in the beginning of 2008. And it really is about the idea of continuous process improvement. Our goal within the program is, even though we're housed in the Department of Administration, we work with all state agencies, and our goal has been to introduce and sustain a continuous process improvement program and efforts within all 24 cabinet-level state agencies. And at the end, I'll give you a bit of an update on where we're at with that effort. Lean is really about, as I mentioned, continuous process improvement. We also are inclusive of, if you're familiar at all with Six Sigma or total quality management, these are very similar methodologies. And as I tell groups, this is not the newest big thing. This is new if you think the 1920s are new. This has been around in some form or fashion for about 90 years, and it has evolved in over that period of time. For those unfamiliar with the Lean, Lean is not an acronym, which is amazing for us in state government. It's actually an adjective, and it talks about the approach and the methods where you attempt to really look at how the work gets done. It really focuses in at the process level of organizations, where the worker bees reside, and figure out the best, most efficient, most effective ways to get the work done. So it really is focused on process improvement. And Lean is really has a strong bent on eliminating waste, or as we call it within process, non-value-added steps. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in a bit. Another key element of the Lean approach is that it engages the people who do the work in making the change. So it isn't the leaders of the organization saying, this is what we're going to do from now on. It's the people who do the work every day. And as Representative Simon mentioned before, our employees are a wealth of knowledge and experience. And if we allow them and give them permission to get involved in improving the processes that they work in, we will see great benefit, and we have seen great benefit to this point. Within our program, we've also tried to be very inclusive with counties, cities, the MNSCU people from other colleges and the University of Minnesota, because processes don't care where they lie. A lot of our processes in state government start at county offices. People go into county offices to apply for veterans benefits or for health care or some of these things. And so counties are key players of our process. And when we've done our Kaizen or rapid process improvement events, we've included county people on those teams because they are part of that process and need to be part of the improvement effort. So we've tried to be very inclusive with other levels of government, and I think that's a good thing to do. We've also tried to be reach out to the private sector and invite them to be part of our efforts. As I mentioned, the private sector has been doing Lean in a lot of places for 30, 40, 50 years. They've got a lot of experience. They've learned a lot. And we've reached out to a number of companies here in Minnesota to help us. One that I'd like to specifically mention has been General Mills, who has been extraordinarily gracious and generous with their time. They've sent senior VPs last year to meet with our leadership, with the commissioners, and talk about why they feel this has great benefit in the state government. This past year, they met with our next level down, the director's levels, and over 300 senior managers within state government met with some General Mills people to hear and learn more about how this can be applied to make them more efficient, more effective, cut costs, and improve performance. And so we really are thankful to that effort on the part of General Mills. Let me give you just kind of a brief summary of our results to date. I mentioned a Kaizen event is a Japanese term, but it's really applied to where you pick out a specific process, you bring together a team of people who work in that process, and you spend a lot of time just, as they say, tearing it apart and reassembling it in a way that reduces the non-value-added activities, improves performance, and makes them more efficient. And in doing that, our average of those 171 or so events that we've held so far is a 66% reduction in the time that it takes to do whatever it is. And we've been in prisons, we've been in warehouses, we've been in offices. The tools of Lean are very flexible and can be used in a whole variety of situations. The other thing we've seen is a 45% reduction in task time. So the actual work that's part of the process is reduced almost by half when you start to eliminate those things that aren't adding value, aren't essential in order to produce the outcomes. As a result of that, we've seen on average about a $90,000 average cost avoidance by implementing these new process improvement activities, and our overall implementation sustainment level is at about 80%. So they always say the biggest challenge is not only to identify and make the changes, but are to sustain them over time. And we're doing okay. I think we can always do better, but 80% is where we're at currently. We're one of three states in the nation that have an enterprise approach going on. The state of Iowa and the state of Ohio are doing this as well. And a lot of other states are thinking about this. They all face similar cost pressures that we do here in Minnesota. And I am constantly answering the phone from New York and California and other states saying, what's going on in Minnesota, and can we learn from what you're doing as well? Lean is not, let me say, lean is simple in its approach, but it's not easy. Improvement is a ground game. It's not the flea flicker where you throw it downfield and hope for the best. It's really you gain improvement yard by yard, day by day, week by week. And so it takes this, as Dr. Edward Deming used to say, constancy of purpose to make this stick and make this work over time. But we've got a great start underway. And just to give you a little bit of where we're at right now, we currently have 9 state agencies that have implemented and have a continuous process improvement effort in place in their agency. 19 of the 24 agencies have conducted at least one Kaizen event, process improvement event, to date. With the Department of Corrections as the current league leader, they've done 31 individual events and seen tremendous results in their operations. We've had 19 agencies that now have trained Kaizen facilitators. Our effort at all of this is to have this grow up within the individual agencies, not to have a big centralized operation, but have each agency adopt this and foster it over time. We've had 22 agencies have people that have gone through our day-long Lean 101 training to provide them the tools and techniques, which includes over 1,300 employees in those 22 agencies. And we've had 1,500 staff people, state employees, have been involved in those 171 Kaizen events to date. So those are just a brief overview of what we've done, and I'd be glad to answer any quick questions or, as I said, come back and talk more.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Bauman, commend the you and the state for doing this, for the efficiencies. I'm just wondering, does this translate on any changes in your employees, in your workforce? Do you have fewer or less as a result of these efficiencies?
Mr. Bauman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one of the things we tell employees at the front end when we have an event like this is that as a result of this, your job will change. I mean, that's often the outcome, is because we're doing work a different way. We often eliminate a number of tasks. What we have seen is that the freed up staff time is often reassigned to other high priority activities within agencies. The agencies that I work with are seeing declining workforces. They are feeling the effects of what's going on. And they're using this to continue to meet the demand of the customers of the services that they provide. And but we're very clear that your jobs will often change as a result of this effort.
Representative Leidiger.
Sir, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You must, as a result, sir, do you keep a database of your what items can be outsourced, what can be or items or functions, I should say, be outsourced or eliminated or consolidated? I mean, it seems to me that the lean approach really looks at best practices. do you keep a log on that by any chance?
Mr. Bauman?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we actually keep a very detailed report out of the changes we make. In these events, we are actually changing the process during that time period or shortly afterwards. And sometimes we have identified those things that we decide we are no longer going to do. And oftentimes we just eliminate an overall work. And so there's not a need to do that. But we are making changes fairly shortly or within 30 days of the event itself.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to make a comment. Of course, we're sitting with a $6 billion budget deficit. And this, what you're doing, is of course what has to happen in government. We need to reduce the size of government. That kind of log, I'd love to have it shared if possible.
We have all the information about all the events on our website. We keep track of those. We check back, and we have progress reports on where we're at. But if you're interested, I can give you the website address, and we keep all the results there.
Representative Gauthier, then we need to conclude.
Mr. Chairman, I would just request that Mr. Bowman come back and give due time to this. I think committee members are interested, and we'd like to have more time.
We will see if we can work that out here in the near future. So, Commissioner Church and your colleagues, thank you for a good overview of a lot of important topics here today, and we expect you folks will be back along the way here with more specific budget requests. We need to approve the minutes. Representative Benson, would you move the minutes?
Mr. Chairman, I move that we accept the minutes.
From yesterday?
Today's meeting.
Okay. Any additions or corrections? If not, all in favor of the minutes signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Minutes are approved. On Tuesday, we've got revenue coming to us, and also legislative auditor. Meeting adjourned.